Tom Diddy Dom Diddy Dom Parry.
Hello, Matt. How are you doing?
I'm not too bad. I decided to give you a new middle name because it's been a while.
I appreciate that. Yeah.
Yeah, I thought, you know, Tom Diddy Dom Parry really suits you.
It's got a nice ring to it, literally.
It has. Maybe we should get into jingles. It's Tom and Matt Attack.
Jingles, that was a jingle. Was it a jingle or is it an intro?
I mean, technically, I think it was a piece of advertising music, isn't it? Like, I don't know how you classify that. Was the song Dom Doo Doo Dom?
No, I'm speaking about our own intro, Matthew.
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, no, ours is definitely an introduction. Ours is a piece of, you know, copyrighted professional music by the great Monsieur Klaus.
Yes, Monsieur Klaus. I like that.
That should be his name. Should be his name. How are you, Tom?
Not too bad, not too bad. Cheers. I'm happy to be podcasting again with yourself, Matthew. It's been a couple of weeks.
It has.
Or, that's it? A couple of weeks more? Feels like an age.
It's been a while. Yeah. It has, as we always say this time. I mean, you can almost guarantee there's going to be at least one Tom and Matt Attack a month, I think, at this point. But yeah, busy lives, busy things going on. And yeah, just that is the way of it. On the brighter note, though, that does mean that generally when we podcast in this day and age, we have some stuff to talk about. Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely, because it's no secret that we probably don't play as many games as we might have used to.
No, and before we get into the talk of video games, I have a book that I would like to talk about.
Oh, gosh.
That is
branching
at
out.
Least game-related.
We did say we'd do this, didn't we?
Yeah, we did. But also, there's a film that you and I have both watched.
Oh,
we both
saw a film. That's always
discussed.
Good. Yeah, good conversation when we've got a film we both watched.
Yeah, so we watched the new Millie Bobby Brown joint on that there Netflix called Damsel.
Yes, and I have to start off by saying I don't really rate Millie Bobby Brown particularly. I don't quite understand why she's so popular. She was good in Stranger Things. But in this film, I didn't think a lot of her performance, I would have to.
So, having seen a lot of the Millie Bobby Brown Netflix back catalogue at this point.
Have you? What have you seen?
I think Enola Holmes is fine.
Yes, Claire saw Enola Holmes and quite enjoyed it.
There are two of them. I've watched them both.
Yeah.
They were fine. They have that Henry Cavill in them, and he's also delightful.
Well, I imagine they had a good story and maybe a bit of comedy in...
Yes, they do. I mean,
which I think were things were distinctly lacking from Damsel.
I mean, I liked the premise. I saw the trailer when it dropped on Netflix, and I was just like, "Oh, this could be good."
Well, that's
been
what
a while
I thought.
Since
it had
I've
a dragon
seen
it.
In it. Yeah,
and you know, stick a dragon in something, and I'm sold. But yeah, I didn't watch it for Millie Bobby Brown, as I say,
Tom,
because I'm not really a fan.
No, but do you like a dragon?
I do like a dragon. Oh,
that's good.
Gosh, sorry.
Yeah, sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Yeah, I like. I'm not against Millie Bobby Brown. She is not a particular actress that I really see as a mark of quality necessarily. In a
well,
project,
I don't think she had quality material to work with here. Really, at least
no.
The script was and the dialogue. Was a little stale.
Yeah,
word.
I mean the right. So the plot of this movie, or the conceit of it, as you will be able to tell from the trailer. In fact, actually, if you watch the trailer, you will pretty much see the entirety of the movie. It's one of those trailers, which is never a good sign. But it is Millie Bobby Brown is the Lady of Winterfell, and I honestly thought the castle that she was living in up north, in clearly like a rural village, was meant to be Winterfell. And then I looked and I was like, oh, it's actually a different place.
I tell you what, you know, it looks nice. Yeah.
It does. It is a very pretty film. So she's in this castle. Some like robed priestesses come from some distant land to say, like, oh, well, your daughter should marry our prince. And so she goes, and there's a typical, like, he was a boy, she was a girl, oh, she's not the princess she thought he thought she was, kind of thing going on. And then it all turns out that, yeah, there's a reason for that. It's because these people have made some kind of pact with this dragon that they have to give their three daughters to this dragon in order to...
Can we... Because there's a lot of... Yeah. I'm jumping ahead. Go on, carry
on. Yeah, let me just say, like, there's essentially, surprise, surprise, Prince Charming isn't Prince Charming. He throws it down a pit to a dragon because this kingdom needs to sacrifice three daughters to a dragon. And the way they trick the dragon is, like, they do the old school Blood Brothers style thing where they both cut each other's hands and, like, rub the wound together. I don't think scientifically that actually works.
No, I don't think it also works, because that dragon might have cottoned on that, hang on, I'm getting all sorts of different ethnicities popping down in my little cave. How can they all be from the same?
Well, because, you know, royalty gets about, I guess. I don't know.
I wasn't sure about that. That was the big reveal, wasn't it? Oh, yes, you think we're all from that family because you smell our blood because Robin Wright touched me and... Well, no, it wasn't Robin Wright. It was the prince. But yeah,
okay. It's not a great film, and pretty much like there's a cat and mouse thing that goes on with Millie Bobby Brown and the dragon.
It's interesting up to the point that she goes into the cave with the dragon, isn't it? It's like the setup. It's like, oh yes, oh dear, they're not all very nice, are they? They just want her to use as a sacrifice. That was. Setup was quite engaging.
I honestly, had the entire movie been like Millie Bobby Brown trying to outwit this dragon in a cave, you know, pretty much the combination of the Riddles in the Dark chapter where Bilbo is trying to outwit Gollum in the caves and then him trying to outwit Smaug. Had it just been like, hey, we're in this place and we're trying to survive and it's an adventure movie where she's trying to, like, outwit this dragon in this thing, I would have kind of been fine with that, but it wasn't really that.
No, there it was that, but it wasn't very... What there was of that wasn't very engaging, I didn't feel.
No, definitely not. And, I mean, they kind of... It felt to me like they tried to get through that bit very quickly, and I'm like, well, this is the most interesting bit of the film, because you know she's going to get out and get revenge on the family, because of course she is. She's the heroine of this tale. Mm. But yeah, I don't know. Like, I just didn't think it was very engaging.
No,
I thought the whole, like, twist of her and the dragon and how they eventually come to tombs with one another and how she gets her revenge just wasn't that great.
No, it wasn't satisfying. That's the problem. It wasn't deserved. I didn't feel like it felt, and then the team kind of became friends very quickly at the end, her and the dragon, very briefly, because they hadn't really spoken that much. I feel like the characters could have... There were some good characters that could have had a bit more development. For example, the queen was ruling the kingdom, wasn't she? She wore the trousers in the relationship. The king character wasn't really very well developed. I think you could have had a few more scenes with Robin Wright sort of being evil and showing her superiority over the king. I think that would have been... To develop her more as a villain, not a one-note villain as she is, you know, in the film.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the insane thing, right, is that you've got Angela Bassett,
yes,
Winston,
Angela Bassett's
Robin Wright.
Good as well, but she doesn't have a lot to do, does she?
I mean, she, to be fair, like, Angela Bassett's character doesn't even have a name until, like, the last 10 minutes.
Oh.
She's just referred to as stepmother.
Obviously, they had a lot of money to throw at this, and they could hire some big names, and they could do some impressive effects, you know, and cinematography, and it all looked very polished. But it felt very much like a very average B-movie type thing with a massive, massive budget.
Yeah, it did. And to be fair, had it been a better one of those, I would have totally be fine with that. Like, I don't think it needed to knock my socks off.
No, if it had been a good script, that and a good story that was engaging throughout, I think, would have been great. He didn't need to throw all that money at it, because I don't think it was a script that deserved to have piles of cash thrown at it.
No, I'm with you on that front. I don't think it was particularly great. I don't think that there was a lot of stuff within there that I
did you cringe
think
a bit
about.
At points? I when she walked out of the castle after dispensing with the queen, with the fire behind her, and she'd got short hair now because she had to cut it at some point. You know, so her transformation was complete. Now she was the warrior princess, but I don't feel that was deserved. I don't feel like she'd gone through enough in that cave to warrant her sort of transformation at the end as some sort of empowered female character. I think that was the idea of it, wasn't it? She was meant.
Well, to be fair, right? Like, I'm less concerned about, because I think like it shows at the start that she is clearly like a girl who can look after, a woman who can look after herself. Like, she's chopping logs, she's doing all these things, and then obviously, like, she's clearly quite strong and everything else. This is just kind of the push that she needed to be like, no, I am the queen of this place up north now.
But did you like her? I didn't really like her as a character. I didn't really feel like I really cared a lot for her in the story.
I don't really, like, have any strong thoughts about any of the characters in this movie.
No,
I think that's perhaps the issue.
I think it could have done with a bit of humour and a lot more character development. I mean, the actors in it, good cast, wasted. I mean, Ray Winston, Winstone, I don't know.
It's Winston, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's spelled Winstone, isn't it?
I know, but like he's
Winston.
He's
let's call him.
He's a cheeky geezer, so I think it's just Ray Winston.
Ray Winston. I mean, he's good, but wow, in this, you know, he doesn't really get to flex his acting muscles particularly. It feels like a bit of a paycheck for everyone involved, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, even Soraya Agdashloo, I think is how you pronounce the actress's name. She's been great. She was good in like 24.
She?
She's the voice of the dragon. like, this is the thing. Like, she's incredible in The Expanse. Like, I love that show. It's very good. She's a very talented actress. Her voice obviously has a lot of gravity to it, but it's not like they really gave her a lot to say other than just being like, no, the reason I'm doing this is strong. Damned humans.
You killed the three, the family in question who were being sacrificed. They killed the dragon three baby girls. That's why they had to be girls, because the dragon had girls, so they have to sacrifice girls because the dragon had girls.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's not very well conceived, is the whole thing. Like, slight spoiler. Ray Winston's character dies after trying to save his daughter after being completely irredeemable for the first half of the movie, where he's just like,
he needs some money for his kingdom. Now, show that, I think. Show how bad things were in that kingdom. A little bit more than they did. I mean, everything was done to the bare minimum. You know, they're struggling a little. I got that, you know. I got they were struggling a little, but really show it. Because he had to have been desperate to sacrifice his own daughter. I don't think it really felt like it was that bad.
No, I don't think so either. But like, this is the whole thing, isn't it? Like, he ends up getting killed by the dragon after coming to save his daughter, whose name is Elodie, which is a nice name for a character.
And she keeps saying L-O-D, the dragon does, all the time.
Yes.
Made me think of level of detail.
Yeah, and it's just like he dies, but like, he's like, I'm here to save my daughter, and the dragon doesn't twig for 1 second. Hang on, actually, they're not the same blood in my weird, like, blood brothers smelling style.
No.
I don't know. It's a poorly conceived movie, I think. There's just not a lot. Clearly, a lot of the budget went into the special effects and the casting. And
it had
think
potential,
the story.
But was squandered, I'm afraid. And it ends up being a very good-looking, average experience.
Yeah,
I felt very disappointed by the film. And to the point where it sort of irritated me. When a film actually has potential to be good, and then they squander it, like I feel was the case with Damsel. I feel really disappointed, you know, because I know that there must be better scripts out there. I know there's better scripts out there, better stories that could be turned into movies, and how this one sort of materializes just feels like a big waste of everybody's time.
No, but so to counteract that point, what I think you have to bear in mind is, Tom, is obviously no one sets out to make a bad movie. No one sets out to have, you know, a film with a script that is subpar and everything else. It's editing, it is, like, budget, it is screen time, like, who knows?
But who looked at that script and thought, that is an interesting script, engaging, great dialogue? I mean, there's none of those things in the script.
You haven't watched as much crap on Netflix as I have.
I've watched a lot of crap, though. Maybe not on Netflix, but you know very well, Matt, I've watched a lot of bad films.
I do. To be fair, like, there's usually a moment in a movie where there's something irredeemable in my eyes in terms of, like, story or characters, and I'm like, Tom Parry would actually really like this movie. Sometimes there's things like that. This I didn't even think of you. I was just like, oh my God, this is...
There isn't good. That sort of it's so bad it's good quality about it at all. It's just middle of the road. It has some entertaining moments, and it has quite an intriguing build-up, but it's lacking any sort of spark. I will say one thing about the film that I quite like. There was a scene where obviously she's surviving, she hasn't got food or water, and there's the stalactites, and you know, she goes to the water, and of course there's a dragon in there, so that then the fire melts the stalactites. It's all a very nice visual.
Well, they're made of ice, you should mention. Like, that's the
reason,
yes,
that's the point. They're made of
ice.
Yeah,
but, like, when it started literally raining on her, I was just like, surely you should be looking up and going, why is this ice melting so
and
fast?
And the bird,
like,
thing was
visual.
Quite good. But when she
the
goes
bird
in...
thing is amazing. That, like, I saw that in the trailer. That was the scene that made me watch this. Like, if you watch the trailer on Netflix, folks, you will see this. There's essentially a scene where the dragon blows fire and you don't see it because it's off screen. And, like, you just hear it chirping, and there's this one bird that flutters in on fire, and you're like, what the hell? And then there's this amazing shot afterwards where, like, loads of these CG birds fly in
on fire.
And it's like, if you've ever seen a large fire up close, it's kind of like the swirls of, like, ash and stuff
embers
that come off the fire. It's incredible. It's incredible. Like, it's a beautiful metaphor for the fire, even though it's obviously what is happening is horrific. And then the way that they land and, like, the cave in this almost, like, church-like way is
it's
amazing.
Almost as if they had a few good visual ideas they wanted to show off in this film. There was good visuals at times. And rather than a good story, that's how I feel about it.
Yeah, I feel the same, and I think that moment with the birds in particular will stay with me. There's a few other cool things. Like I said, the stalactite thing that you mentioned, I thought the scene with, like, the glowing worm things.
The worms.
Kind of cool, even though they don't really make any sense, that there's magical worms that can heal you.
The magical worms when she throws them on the dragon.
Hey man, it's a strange movie. I do not recommend it. You've gotten, again, from watching the trailer and this, you will have probably gotten all you want out of it.
This is it, you know. I say don't waste your time on it. There's a couple of key scenes that you might want to look at from a purely visual standpoint. But otherwise, if you want an engaging story, then I'd steer clear of Damsel.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to say. Well, we've talked for 20 minutes about Damsel.
We have, yeah. No, we should move on. Yeah. It's half the runtime of the film, it felt like.
It doesn't deserve this much time.
No, it doesn't. Transitioning to a game that I'm not sure deserves as much time as I put into it, I have beaten Final Fantasy VII Rebirth. Right, so I have a lot of feelings about this game. I'm not going to talk spoilers, so don't worry if you are not all the way through the very, very long game that is Final Fantasy VII Rebirth. Of course, this is the second part of this new trilogy of Final Fantasy VII Remake games. It started with Remake in 2020, that hit as the pandemic started. And here we are 4 years later with the second entry into that, which pretty much takes you from you leaving Midgar in the original Final Fantasy VII and then going through the travels.
How different is it, Matthew, before we continue? Because it's the story is slightly different than the original game story. Is that correct, or am I?
Yes, right. So the key conceit of Final Fantasy VII Remake is that there are slight differences in the story. Mm. And the thing that I came away with, without saying too much, was that much like the Evangelion remake of the mid-2000s and into late 2000s by the end of them getting released, was that this was a piecing conversation with itself. They were trying to make a Final Fantasy VII remake that was obviously giving fans what they want, in that you see Cloud and Tifa and Barret and everyone else in beautiful graphics and you go to the same places. But it very much felt like a story in conversation with itself, like, hey, you played this game 20 years ago, here's what we think of these scenes and these setups and everything else we're doing. And you finished that first game with a hope that potentially there would be some new things happening in this world beyond just them fleshing out story beats that never really paid off within the original game. And so, cut to this. It is very different, I will say. There was the first game was pretty linear, as is that entire section of Midgar anyways. Obviously, you could walk around. There were mini-games and stuff to do. And it feels to me like, A, they learned the wrong lessons from both Advent Children and that original remake in terms of what people wanted from a Final Fantasy VII thing, in that it feels very anime at points, in which the original game didn't necessarily feel like, very over-the-top fights and everything else. Everything dialed up to 11, which is like, great, I get why you do that at the end of Remake, but when you're just doing that in casual moments here, it doesn't really do a lot. It starts with an absolutely bonkers plot beat as well that I shan't get into, but it is the biggest head-scratch moment that I have ever had playing a game, and it really sets the expectations for, like, what the hell is going to happen in this game? Like, why is this happening? How is this even possible within the timeline and the constellation of the story? This doesn't make any sense. And what it ends up being, Tom, is you go through chapters in this game. And I was ready to come on this podcast and decry the Assassin's Creeding of, like, every video game now, because you go into big open world areas, there are towers for you to climb, and those towers unlock, like, small, like, challenges within the world, be that side quests or monsters you need to kill or things you need to dig up with your chocobo. And obviously that pads the game out an awful lot. I was ready, like I said, to be like, oh my god, like, there's this tower aspect of it, like, every single beat of the game seems like it's pulled out into a needlessly fiddly and often varying in quality mini game. Like, there's a point in time where I played what can only be described as a very bad Rocket League clone.
Yeah.
And that was the point where I said, okay, I'm done with these mini games. I just don't care. I'm gonna get over them to get for the sake of the story, for what I need to do, and then I'm just gonna move on. But then, Tom, then I thought about the original Final Fantasy VII, which you have played, right? You have played quite a bit of the original FF7.
I wouldn't say quite a bit. I think it's an exaggeration.
Right. Okay.
I've played about an hour or so.
Okay, then I can't really have the conversation I was willing to
have. I'm afraid not, sorry.
It's okay, but what I will say is, while I was like, the Assassin's Creeding of video games, the more I thought about it, and the more I just wanted to be like, oh my god, there's so many mini-games in this, what the hell is going on? The more I thought back to the original Final Fantasy VII, and I'm like, no, they've done what they said they were going to do. This is a remake. Like, There are points where Cloud will walk up to a wall and you will hear the shriek sound in the original Final Fantasy VII and he'll climb up something. But obviously, because this is a modern video game and it isn't enough for you to just spend like 3 seconds climbing up a screen into a new area, you need to traverse that like you would a modern video game, which, you know, means it takes like a minute or two. And I think they've taken these things that were like fun little interactions and beats in the original game and they've like tried to squeeze them for all they're worth. Like the Rocket League thing is probably because at one point you're on a beach in Costa del Sol and there are kids kicking a football back and forth with Red and they've gone like, oh, right, this moment, we're going to take this, we're going to make a mini game. There is lots of stuff like, let me think of a game. One of the earlier areas of the game is Junon, which is one of the areas in Final Fantasy VII. And in the original game, there was a small mini game section where you had to jump on a dolphin to get up to a point. And that is here, but now it's like wave race. Like, ooh, you do a really bad wave race.
Oh, okay. So it's not
the back
good
of a dolphin.
Game. Right, okay.
No. Sure. And there are points and prizes awarded based on you doing this. And it's like, it's needlessly fiddly. And this is something that maybe took you like 30 seconds to a minute max within the original game is now fleshed out into a 3-minute mini game.
Okay. I don't like this idea of stretching the length of something which is already quite long to begin with, yeah?
Yeah, and I mean, it's no cakewalk. Like, I played a ton of this game the week it came out, to the point of, honestly, like, I think if you were to play this game like a regular person where you would dip in and out a bit and go like, well, you know, I'll play like an hour here and there, maybe it wouldn't feel as tedious, but playing it the week it came out in order to try and get ahead of spoilers for this game, because I was like, well, there's clearly some crazy plot stuff that's going to go on. I don't want this game to be spoiled for me because I care about these characters in this universe. I want to play it. I don't know. It just felt very contrived and very forced and very artificially lengthened, which I guess if you're playing making a very long game, people are going to get their money's worth and everything else. But like, I put almost 50 hours into it by the end. And I had to stop myself going around and doing all the side stuff. Because I was just like, there's no reward for this. This doesn't pay off in any meaningful way. The minigames are slightly tedious at best, with the exception being Queen's Blood, which is the in-world card game in this game, like they have done in the past, which is very good. I did actually do all of the Queen's Blood stuff because it didn't take that long a time, and I thought it was actually quite a well-conceived minigame. I don't know. Especially with how the story progressed and how they seemed like they wanted to have this conversation with the original work, but then when push came to shove, I don't think they really thought about how they wanted to do that, is what I will say about how the game progresses. It kind of leaves me a bit sad. It's just, I wish it were more in line with the end of Evangelion movies, you know, like those, the 4 Evangelion movies that Anno released and were clearly like more of a thought out, poignant, considered conversation with the original works. Because I think this is trying to do that, but clearly they didn't really succeed in my eyes. And I'm actually kind of concerned that they won't stick the landing in the third act either. So,
and is there just one more game left in this series?
Just one more game, supposedly. Who knows how that'll churn out, but there's just one more game, supposedly. And I, again, having played this and it being so long and so tedious at points, like, the combat is great. The combat, they've massively improved from the original game. They did some of that originally in the intermission, the Yuffie expansion that they released when they pushed the game out on PS5, which I played. I think it's only like 2 hours long. It's very good. They released that with the PS5, and I played it just before playing this because I was like, well, looking at the back of the box, Yuffie is in this game, so I should probably know what happened in that side story. I don't know, man. I was a little bit disappointed.
Oh dear, this has been an episode of disappointments.
It has. It is what it is. I I would love to have a more nuanced conversation about this, but I don't think, if you've not played that original game, Tom, I don't think I can even have it on this podcast. But, like, needless to say, I'm not thrilled about it. I probably won't talk about it again on this podcast because I don't think I will go back and play it. What I'm actually looking forward to now that this is done is going to complete Persona 3, and then from Persona 3 going to play Like a Dragon Infinite Wealth, because I still haven't been able to start that game. So
wow sorry.
That's okay. Yeah, the yawns all round, Tom Parry. That is how I feel.
Yeah, Like a Dragon Infinite Wealth. Now, that's the latest installment in the Like a Dragon series.
Yes.
The sequel to Like a Dragon, or...
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
And in canonically, I guess, Yakuza 8, if you don't count any of the spin-offs, and Gaiden...
Yeah, I feel like there were two that came out very close to each other. Was that
Yeah, so what ended up happening was we got Ishin very early last year, around this time, I believe. Then in September, I think it was, we got Like a Dragon Gaiden, the man who erased his name.
That one, yeah. That's one.
And now we have Yakuza 8, or aka Like a Dragon Infinite Wealth.
Okay, right. I just wanted to get that straight. I couldn't quite remember.
No, it is what it is. But no, I'm very much looking forward to playing that game.
Yeah, that's been well received, hasn't it?
It has. I've heard nothing but good things from people I know who have played it, and also podcasters talking about it and reviewing it, especially in comparison to Final Fantasy VII Rebirth. So, let's see. I'm looking forward to playing it. I probably won't be able to touch it this side of Easter because I want to finish off Persona. But let's see. I've made my peace with it. I enjoyed certain aspects of Final Fantasy VII Rebirth. Obviously, like, I like...
You say it was better than the previous one, or you prefer
that
one?
No, Right, combat-wise, like, gameplay-wise, I would say yes, Rebirth definitely has some more going for it. I do think the open world stuff is kind of cool. I do think being able to go around these maps and collect things and everything else is actually... I wanted to be like, oh, the Assassin's Creed of video games. But no, I genuinely do think that this is what they set out to do. They've modernized the original Final Fantasy VII.
Hmm.
And I'm just not sure if that's for better or worse.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Yeah, point.
I think the combat is solid. I do really enjoy it. I think that they've made it harder to cheese material in the same way that you could in the first game, where you could just chain things together and do insane attacks. I think they've figured out interesting ways to get around that, but still make the combat feel fresh and slightly better than it was in the original game. But again, there's nothing there to draw me back into that world, I think. I'm pretty much just going to deinstall it and then just wait for Yakuza 8 and get into that when I can.
Okay, so it's a very busy time, as you'd said previously in the last episode. There's lots of games coming out or already released that you wanted to play. You're just sort of playing catch-up now a bit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I mean, you know, like, admittedly, I'm definitely probably not going to buy it at launch. Dragon's Dogma 2 is on the horizon. That game looks very, very good. Princess Peach Showtime even looks interesting, but I'm going to pick that up either. I will get, what's the name of it, Tom? The Capcom game.
Capcom game?
Capcom, isn't it Capcom? That the sci-fi game that's coming out soon, that's like Nier.
Oh, yeah, I know what you're talking about. I don't think it's Capcom. No.
Do you mean? Oh, no, it isn't. Is it? Yeah, we talked about it. It's a Korean developer, Stellblade. Yeah, for some reason in my head, I've conflated it with that Capcom sci-fi game that was announced like 3 years ago in a PlayStation.
Oh, that one.
Experience that we haven't seen anything of.
Do you remember when Perfect Dark was announced?
Yeah, I do. Do you remember when Fable was announced? Oh, classics that we're probably not going to see for another 6 years. Stellar Blade's going to come out. I'm going to play that because I like Nier and it looks interesting.
It does look interesting.
take from the words looks interesting what you will. I don't know. There's a lot of stuff coming out and there's a lot of games that I have on the backlog already. Yeah. And as we've discussed at the tent. Yeah. I don't have that much time to play games anymore. So, let's see.
When I have time to play games, which I do have time. However, I choose to spend that time, game playing time, playing Sonic Origins.
Oh, of course.
So I've now, I've got the Platinum on PS4, PS5, and the equivalent on Xbox now. I'm going through, even though you don't get achievements on the Switch, I'm trying to do all the achievements on the Switch, even though I'm going to get nothing from it.
Right.
Other than the enjoyment of playing those games, as I feel at this time, they're quite therapeutic for me. And I think sometimes you just want comfort games. And this morning, I was playing through the story mode on Sonic Origins, and I managed to get all the Chaos Emeralds with Tails. And this is something that I never tend to do, because Tails is a little bit of a hindrance all the time in the special stages on Sonic 2. You do have to allow for him a bit by jumping earlier and, you know, being extra careful. So yeah, it helps that in Sonic Origins you can retry special stages, and having jumped back to the original game just to remind myself what that was like. So Origins is quite different.
Yeah,
there's several tweaks in Origins versions of the Sonic games that make them more accessible. For example, if you play the anniversary modes, you get in widescreen, which actually does make a difference to the experience. I think it does improve the games and does make them slightly easier, because you can see further ahead of you. Okay. Also, it's quite helpful in the special stages. Things like you keep all your rings when you finish a special stage. You don't have them taken away from you. So that speeds things up. So you can get Supersonic on the first level of Sonic 2 fairly easily. You know. So there's a lot of sort of these little things that make the game very easy to come back to. I think that's great. I think this is the perfect package. You can play the original version of the games, but you also have this anniversary mode, which is just makes playing them a lot less frustrating.
Yeah, I think that is a good thing to do with older games, right? Mm. It's just like if you can lower that barrier to entry. I was actually talking to my brother about this the other day, and how we had a conversation about how he was loving some of the newer Nintendo games. Like, he was playing Mario Kart 8 with his 4-year-old and saying, like, I love that there are accessibility options now for the kids to play these games. And, like, he even has the Super Nintendo Classic, and the fact you can create save states and stuff. He said, like, it just makes those games more accessible, because he was just like, well, you said games when we were kids, it was just so hard.
Yeah, well, like, I think back then there wasn't as many games, was there? I suppose there was still plenty, but now there's so much to play. Any sort of accessibility features to sort of quicken up the time you might spend playing through the game is good. I saw on Nintendo, to my Nintendo, that I would get some bonus points if I play Super Mario World. So I played a bit of Super Mario World earlier, and I was like, gosh, this is hard.
It is, but like...
And I was thinking, oh, what if there was a Sonic Origins equivalent? You know, like a Mario equivalent, Sonic Origins, you know, where there were some more... and Nintendo have certainly implemented this, as you're saying, into some of their later games. But to add that into older games, actually, I think is a really good way to go. But then still provide the original experience.
Yeah.
Like in Sonic Origins. So, I've just really enjoyed playing Sonic Origins. And there's something, I think, about that momentum-based platforming that I really enjoy. It made me go back and play a little bit of Freedom Planet again, which is similar, momentum-based, you know, it's fast. It's not exactly like Sonic, but it certainly shares its influences. And also, I just really like platform games. I played a little bit of Spectacular Sparky, which I've probably mentioned before, which is a sort of run-and-gun platformer with some really nice pixel graphics on the... I've played it on the Switch, but it's probably available on the stuff.
We've talked about this. I like the aesthetic.
It's quality, and it's got a lot of funny dialogue as well. A lot of dialogue, maybe a bit too much dialogue, but it's quite funny what there is in there. Great presentation. I just do really love 2D platformers, and it seems to be that and racing games. Also, wrestling games. I picked up AEW Fight Forever on the PS5 recently.
Okay.
I should have got it on the PS4, I think. I think it's slightly cheaper because really this doesn't need a PS5.
No.
Visually, it's, you know, I knew not to expect too much from it because I'm sure it doesn't have a massive budget like the WWE games do. But the gameplay is pretty great. Yeah, it's very reminiscent of the older wrestling games, particularly the ones on the N64, WCW versus NWO, and WrestleMania 2000, No Mercy.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's that type of wrestling game, and I've always got time for an arcade-style wrestling game. So,
me too.
It's got some neat little things in the story mode where between the matches you can do a bit of training, which is really just a cutscene, but basically you have four turns before each match to do something. But they add a little bit of comedy, and other wrestlers can sort of interrupt your training and challenge you and things like that. You don't actively do any mini-game in the training, but there is actually a separate mini-game option you can do is one of your four events between doing the main events. Yeah. So those mini games are pretty silly. They're sort of like, there's some memory games in there. There's some sort of collective, they're very wacky sort of party game type stuff. There's a bit of trivia, which if you don't know AEW, like I don't particularly, then you're not going to last in the trivia mini games at all. But it's nice that it's there. It's a go sightseeing. You go out for a meal, you know, in between. And at first I thought, oh, God, these really sort of slow down everything a little bit. But there is quite a bit of entertainment value within those activities that you can do between the matches. And they build up certain stats for your wrestler. It's really made for, say, if you've created a wrestler, and then you can build him up in the, it's a career mode, essentially. And then you can, those will carry over into the other modes as well. So it's really cool for you. Created wrestler type characters. I'm using a pre-done wrestler because I was a bit lazy and didn't want to make one at the time. But it's a fun game. It's a good price now, I think. I think it would be far too much what it came out at. I recall this being a full price game, or at least £40 game in the UK. It's now been slashed in price. I picked up for £20 for the PS5 version, which I thought was quite good. Yesterday I saw in Smith's Toys they had the £15 PS4 version with PS5 upgrade. I thought that would have been, probably been a better
way to go. That would have been a better option, yeah.
Because, it's just £5 cheaper and you can get both games. But I think I would recommend it if you're a fan of wrestling games, particularly the old school arcade style, talking about the N64 ones, even SmackDown, if you were a fan of SmackDown. I think you get a lot out of this, and it's good that it exists as a sort of option, because the latest official games, you know, that they've become a little bit more simulator-ish. So it's a cool game. I mean, you don't expect it to blow your socks off in the graphics and presentation department, because it does look a little bit ropey.
Well, to be fair, I think the expectation for wrestling games is relatively low, right? Even though I have heard good things about the new WWE game.
Okay.
Since they stopped working with their long-term developer that I can't remember the name of. I've heard that that game is decent. But again, graphics are not something I necessarily associate with a wrestling game.
Yeah, I think the latest WWE ones are particularly nice to look at. At least they were on the last generation, PS4, Xbox One. I found the WWE games to look particularly good, and I think they've just took that up a notch with this next gen. But yeah, the AEW game is pretty much a throwback, I would say. Which is, you know, a good thing if you're after that kind of game on a modern system.
I mean, exactly. I mean, does it kind of like edge closer to like Fire Pro games, would you say?
No. I'd say that is still a thing of its own, Fire Pro Wrestling.
Okay.
That is a very unique proposition, I think, still within in wrestling games. But, you know, maybe similar in terms of gameplay.
Yeah, I just knowing that AEW kind of like people like Kenny Omega, like I don't really know
Kenny Omega. Yeah, he's the only
Kenny
one
Omega,
I really know. And Sting's like, in there, and I think Chris Jericho wrestles. Yeah, he does AEW, so he's in.
Okay.
So there are a few familiar faces. There's quite a few Japanese wrestlers as well in AEW.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Yeah. Like a lot, because Kenny Omega was wrestling in in the Japanese wrestling league. Yeah. The name escapes me, and I know a lot of those Japanese wrestlers then came with him to form AEW. So
I think it's very popular AEW. I'm just not very familiar with it, but the game itself is fun. So like I can recommend it, especially now it's got a lot cheaper.
That is good. Okay, so yeah. Seeing as we are on the upswing of actually recommending stuff on this podcast, I got this amazing book out of the library. It was there. It called to me from the shelves, and I was like, oh, hello, book that
I would very
book
review
like
time. We need a jingle for Book Corner.
Yeah, Book Corner.
Pick up your book, Book Corner. Why don't you take a look, Book Corner.
Tom
the pages.
And Matt a book.
okay, that could do with some work, but you know.
It can. We'll workshop it. It's fine. We'll leave it in just so people get a hint of behind the scenes magic of whatever the book jingle becomes. No, they had a book on the shelf called A Handheld History, a celebration
right
of portable gaming.
Right
up my street, boy. What it is essentially a beautiful love letter to most of the big handheld gaming systems. It's published by a label that I've not heard of called Lost in Cult, which is apparently a part of a big publisher called Expanse, which is HarperCollins. But generally it's a big book,
the pictures.
As you can see. Tom, not only are there lots of pictures of various consoles.
Oh, that's sexy. And I thought writing as well.
There is a lot of writing. There's a lot of thought that has clearly gone into this book. It not only talks about the history of the console, like what it was in relation to the market of games at
the
time. So
this isn't just Game Boy?
No, it isn't just Game Boy. It goes miles beyond there. It goes even into the Switch. It goes through the full run of the Nintendo consoles, obviously. The Game Gear is here, the PSP is here, the Vita, bless it. I've just seen a picture of the beautiful Nintendo Labo, Nintendo Switch that I wish I owned. And even beyond that, Tom, it goes into, that I love, some of the more obscure gaming handhelds, in that it talks about things like the Game King and the Game.com and the Gizmodo. It starts to talk. Oh, Gizmondo, sorry, not Gizmodo. Gizmodo is a website. It talks about like lots of things: Tiger handheld electronics, the Game Mate, the Mega Duck. It's got lots of write ups about lots of these things, and it also
Sega
talks
Nomad.
About things. Sega Nomad's probably in here actually, because it talks about things like the Evercade. Yeah. It brings up things like the Analog Pocket and that's place in trying to talk about the, you know, like modern retro gaming and everything else. Actually, I can tell you, because fortunately at the start of the book, they have a beautiful color-coded, so you can tell which different manufacturer we're talking about and which era of gaming. Would you believe, I don't think the Sega Nomad is actually in here, despite the Turbo Express being in here.
It should be, really, shouldn't it? Because it is both a handheld and a console, you can use it. Can you use that on a connect to a TV? Can't you, Nomad?
I think you can. Yeah, I think you can. I think you can plug it via a cable. Actually, that's quite surprising. That isn't in here, seeing as they talk about like the VMU.
I was just going to say VMU. They got the Pocket Station in there.
In there as well. Exactly. Mm. Like it is a treasure trove of very thoughtful articles. Yeah. Also beautiful imagery of all of these consoles.
What's it called again, Matthew? Remind our listeners what
it is
about.
Called A Handheld History, a celebration of portable gaming. It is a beautiful thing. I will actually pick up a copy of this for myself, because I've read a lot of it, but as you say, there's a lot to get through, and it just feels like it's going to be one of those nice things to have on a shelf.
Absolutely.
And occasionally take
to
a flick
refer
through
to
and read.
The coffee table book.
It is, but I think it does a damned good job of also capturing some of the, like, hey, these are also so good games for these systems. This is the highest selling games. This is, you know, some obscure gems that you might not have heard of. It covers things like Judgment Silver Sword on the Wonder Swan in their section. It brings up the Klonoa game. It's got Rhythm Rider.
Nicely laid out.
Yeah, it's a gorgeous, gorgeous thing. And some of the illustrations it's got throughout as well are also really, really nice. I cannot recommend it enough. Like I said, I'm going to pick up a copy for myself.
Classy stuff. There's a page, like two-page spread here of all those different models of Game Boy from DMG. Even the Manchester United Game Boy I see there.
Exactly. It's got a little bit of everything. I really want to pick up my own copy so I can just browse it at my leisure, because unfortunately I need to return it soon. But yeah, it's really good.
I've got a little story I want to share, actually.
Okay.
Yeah. So I've been... I was trying to trade in a copy of Wario World for the GameCube at CX. Now, I have two copies somehow. I don't know. Don't tell me how I have two copies. Oh, ask me how, because I don't know. But yeah, I have two copies. So I went in there and I tried
trading. Hopefully one of them wasn't mine.
Is it?
I don't know. I don't know. I'll have to check my shelf, but right, I definitely had one.
Anyway, I have two. So I was trying to get rid, but I haven't been able to get rid, because I looked online and I saw, ooh, I could get £40 cash for this.
Crikey.
With them selling it on at £70. I thought, well, you know what? I'd be happy with £40. I don't know where this came from. I do hope it's not yours. And it's got the game writing on. You know, when you trade in a game at game, they'd write over the barcode and they'd write something on the instruction manual. It's got all that. The disc is a few light scratches. It plays. I made sure it played, but that was my problem the first time I tried to trade it in. He was like, nah, this scratch, I can feel it with my fingernail. I can't trade this in. I'm sorry. I did say, well, it does work. You know, I did try it some more. He says, without a GameCube to test it on, I'm not going to be able to trade it in. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I says, okay, fair enough. He's just doing his job, right? So I came back again when he wasn't there, and I tried to get, you know, trade it in.
Yeah.
You know, again, you might as well. I wanted the cash. And... The woman who's serving me, she said, "Oh, I'm sorry, this has been discontinued." I'm like, discontinued? You just not trading this particular game in? And I'd never encountered that. I haven't done my research and seen online if anyone has any similar stories. But I imagine then they're not allowed to trade it in anymore for some reason.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And I was thinking, well. Yeah, are there certain GameCube games then don't want to take in now?
Yeah, no, so I'm just quickly looked on the CEX Reddit, and someone else has run into this and says, would not take games because they were discontinued. I tried to trade in two Dreamcast games today and they are showing on the app and are worth over £10. However, tried trading them in and could not be accepted because they were discontinued. And so someone said, discontinued items will continue to show for sale online as long as they're in stock. However, no more items will be accepted.
So they are cracking down on their retro. They're stopping trading in as much retro stuff then.
Yeah.
Why a game like Wario World, which has a value, you'd think they just don't want a load of crap, basically. You'd think a game that... Obviously, there's people who want to purchase that game. They could certainly sell it. It's strange, because, yeah...
Yeah, I wouldn't have assumed, like, I've seen, like, retro shops, like, small businesses turn away video games and go like, well, we're probably not going to sell this. Like, I had a couple of the SingStar copies of, like, SingStar Kent that I bought for the PS2. That I, in all fairness, now I'm kind of glad I didn't trade them in, because, like, places were like, no, we don't really accept SingStar games, we'll give you, like, a quid. And I was like, well, no, I'm not going to take a quid for it. But they wouldn't give me what eBay...
It would be a penny to 10p in CEX now.
Yeah, and it's now a couple of hundred quid. So I'm kind of happy they didn't. But yeah, I've had that.
And by the way, like... SingStar Kent isn't a Kent-specific version of SingStar in terms of the location in the UK, Kent. It is a group, isn't it?
It is, pop group. Actually, I can see that this has come down in value even. Like, there's a copy on eBay at the moment, pre-owned, which is, 60 quid? Yeah. So even that's come down, but... Yeah, but I've curious, seen people do that.
Because last week, a couple of weeks ago, I could trade that game in, but now I'm not. And I did think at first, is this some sort of, have they got me? Can they tell it's me? Because they denied me the trade in the other week. You know, I started to feel like I was sort of targeted or victimised a little bit. But I'm pretty sure that's not the case. Because you didn't even check the disc. So, yeah. And I'd never seen this woman before in my life. So I don't think it's that. It is, as you say, as you've proven now, that they aren't taking certain games anymore.
Maybe there is just a threshold over when they get over which they will not tick any more stuff. You know, maybe it's like if they have 10 in stock online or something, they're just like, well, we don't need any more of this.
Yeah, fascinating.
I guess it's maybe it's to prevent abuse of the system also. Maybe, like, I know people buy cases of games or something. Maybe it's just to stop places that have a lot of stock being able to trade in multiple copies of a game or something like that. Who knows?
Yeah, who knows? Anyway, I'll try and sell it on eBay. I'm pretty certain it's not yours, but I just can't remember where.
I'm going to check, though.
I really don't think it is. Anyway, I played it again recently, and it was all right.
It's not bad.
It's a game that I'd managed to completely forget existed until I realised I had two copies of it. But yeah, it's not bad. Yeah, quite like playing that again. I've got my PS1 and GameCube sitting on top of me CRT TV in the living room now. But of course, by doing that, I couldn't have wires anymore because they'd just be dangling in front of the telly. So I've had to use wireless solutions. And I've got this little wireless adapter that lets you connect any sort of wireless controller to your PS1.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, I've got a WaveBird, which is fine, but I have to get this little adapter. And they also work on PS2, those adapters do too. So they're really good. So you can play your PS1 with your, say, a PS4 controller.
Yeah.
That's really nice. Yeah.
That's good.
Been really into the Namco games just lately. Because Namco on PS1, it's like a fine wine. Especially, you know, when you get to a certain point and you've got Ridge Racer Type 4 and Ace Combat 3. Mr. Driller G. There's a presentation to these Namco games that is just exquisite. You know, the latest Smash Court Tennis as well. You know, like Smash Court Tennis 3 is another. We talked about this briefly, didn't we? Like gaming aesthetics and presentation. And I think back on the PS1, Namco were firing on all cylinders with their presentation. And I think Type 4, as we've said before, Ridge Race Type 4 is one of the best examples, of course, Wipeout as well, outside of Namco. I was like Street Fighter Alpha 3, you know, it's got a nice presentation about it. But
yeah, I mean, I always remember loving the Namco Museum games. Mm. Just even the boxes of those, always like just using the letters from the Namco logos, and like, I should buy those.
They can be quite pricey, I think.
Oh, I just love the. I just need the print.
Yeah, I'm very much into getting the Japanese copies of games now because having a PlayStation, it's region free, and having that full screen 60 frames per second sort of experience on a lot of these games, it's really nice. So I recently got Ridge Race Type 4, the Japanese version, and it's, you know, despite not being able to appreciate the story in that game, because it's all in Japanese, all the menus are in English, so it is really accessible. All the main things you might need to know.
Yeah.
It's such a great game, Ridge Racer Type 4, and I thought a lot about what I'm doing lately when I'm playing games. I'm just playing things that I really love a lot. Like Sonic or Ridge Racer, you know, Shenmue, Tetris, you know, there are certain games that I'm just finding immense comfort in going back to, and also Guitar Hero. I've been playing Guitar Hero again a little bit and really enjoying that.
I'm glad, Tom. I'm glad you're finding comfort in old games.
That's a big factor of video games, isn't it? Maybe when things get a bit too much in life or going through a difficult period of time, that video games can offer an immense comfort, especially ones that you're very familiar with, and they remind you perhaps of a different time in your life when Yeah, you were younger. That there was less to worry about. You must know that as well. Is there any games that you see return to when you want that sort of comfort feeling?
I mean, for me, like Kirby's Dream Land is the one I will always go to, or some of the Mario games.
Yeah. You can almost take yourself back to that moment in time, can't you? Or where you played them, particularly mean the Master System Sonic games, which is or Alex Kidd, you know, things like that. Wonder Boy, Monster Land. It's nice. I've got these games, and I keep going back to the same ones. It's terrible, really.
No, I really wish I could find my play date because I still can't find it. I don't know why I've squirreled it away in a drawer. I'm sure, but I don't know what it is because speaking of comfort games, like I really like playing Return of the Obra Dinn. Like that is like my. If I'm going to play like a more modern game and just pop something on, like play, I love the aesthetic of that game for some reason.
I can't recall what this game is.
It's a mystery aboard a ship. The reason I bring it up is because it reminded me that there is a new Lucas Pope game. He's the guy who made Return of the Obra Dinn and also Papers, Please, called Mars After Midnight, that's just been released and it's exclusively on the Playdate. And I would love to play it, but I can't find the Playdate.
No. Unfortunately,
I love a little small game. I just love having a fiddle. I just like having a quick.
Matt likes a quick fiddle.
I know. I shouldn't have said it. I realised as soon as I did. It's because of the crank. I was just like, I was trying to avoid saying I like having a little bit of a crank because that also sounds wrong.
Yeah.
I like games that are small. I like
UFO.
Part-time UFO, exactly.
Vibribbon.
We've had this conversation before. Vibribbon, exactly.
Yeah. So when you're not playing your epic adventure RPG type games,
life's too short, man. Like I can't keep playing very long games.
But I imagine even Final Fantasy VII is a comfort game for a lot of people.
It is, and to be honest with you, it certainly was for me. I've played that game an awful amount, especially that and FF6. Between them, I've played both countless times.
Yeah. That's a fair move for me, you know. I think nothing of just playing through that.
Well, I mean, it, like a new Like a Dragon game for me, right? Yeah. Like any entry in the Yakuza series I love, and there's just something comforting about the simplicity of the combat and the silliness of the story and everything else. Though they are quite long. That's my only... The only thing of like why I can't really say it's a comfort game because I don't play them in the same way as a Kirby or something where I dip in and out.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm just jumping around subjects, Matt. I hope you don't mind. I did connect my Spectrum up to the telly the other day and was reminded why I don't usually bother with it.
Yeah.
Spent ages trying to get a tape to play. When I finally did, all the controls were backwards when I on my joystick, so I was trying to play Jet Set Willy, but I think to move forward jumped, and I kept like turning the wrong way. I think I had to push left to go right. Anyway, really? after all that time of trying, I don't know why, but I thought, well. Thank gosh for those Xbox 360 indie versions of Jet Set Willy and Manic Miner. which I don't even know if they work anymore. I think you've got trials of Xbox Live Indies, they won't work. But I think if you purchased it, I think they still...
I think if you purchased them, they're still fine, yeah.
Yeah. And I played a bit of Resident Evil 4 really, because that's another sort of comfort game.
The remake or the...
Well, actually, it was just the regular original on the Switch.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, I must get back to that remake. Because it's funny, like, I'm doing stuff on the Switch one that I didn't do so long ago in the remake. And it is very interesting to play them, actually. You know, go back and forth between the two. I did that with Conker's Bad Fur Day on the N64 and the Xbox. It's fascinating... thing to do is to play a remake alongside, maybe it doesn't work with Final Fantasy because they're so different, but Resident Evil is different in a lot of ways, but you know, there are also still Resident Evil 4.
I mean, you could do that with Final Fantasy VII, and honestly, like, I was thinking about doing it, 'cause I was like, well, this section in Final Fantasy VII Original is like an hour long, and I've played it for six now, so...
Mm.
What I kind of ended up doing was like, did this happen this way in the original? I would open a guide and read the story beat of the guide and be like, oh yeah, no, this did happen. I'm just forgetting this. I'm just getting old and it's been a while since I've replayed it. So
yeah. There you go. I don't think, and I could talk about Sonic the Hedgehog more, but I think I'll leave it there. I think we've talked enough about Sonic this episode.
We have. I mean, we talk about Sonic. Every episode, we've name dropped the games that we always name drop.
One more Sonic related thing.
What?
I tried to go back to Sonic Frontiers, and I'm stuck on a particular boss, and it just annoyed me to the point of frustration. And I don't know when I'm going to be able to gear myself up to play that again.
Fair enough. That's a shame.
It is a shame. It's just there's a bit in it where you have to time something, and the timing is very difficult to. Well, I find very difficult to get right, and you have to do a. It's one of those things where you do a whole section, and then you get up to the bit you're struggling on. You mess it up again, and then you end up repeating the whole section before it again over and over, and that's the same thing for Sonic Superstars as well. If I ever go back to that, I have to replay a huge bit until I get up to the boss fight, and then, have the same problems.
That sucks. If it makes you feel any better, there's a boss fight in Final Fantasy VII Rebirth.
Yeah.
That is also the cutscenes as part of it are part of the boss fight, so you're forced to watch the cutscenes again and again, which is very frustrating.
You know, it does that a bit in Tekken 8 story mode as well.
Yeah. Have you watched the thingy yet? Oh my god! What are you doing?
I forgot.
So glad I've got a pop shield on to do from that. I can't believe it. I can't believe it.
Right, okay, Matt. I'm gonna watch it right after this.
Good.
I just keep forgetting. You keep telling me to watch it. Here we are. I'll open it now in YouTube. I've got it here. It's only 5 minutes long.
It is. It is only 5 minutes long of Brian Cox telling you the story of Tekken. Have you not watched it?
I'm going to watch it right after this.
Good. So the first thing I'm going to ask you next week is...
Well, not next week. I've got like two weeks or so to watch
it. Yes, this is true. This is true.
I'll have
but
forgotten
like,
it all
next right. time we podcast, next month sometime, the first thing I'm going to ask you, Tom, is what do you think of Brian Cox's retelling?
I can tell you
what
I probably
King
think it's
Fist.
Great because I like Brian Cox.
I'm going to watch you do it right now to make sure you do
it. Yeah, let's do it. Let's do it together. Let's have a watch along.
Okay, cool. If you would like to have a watch along with us, please do, and let us know your feelings about the Brian Cox Tekken video, if you haven't already, on the various places we do the social media. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/TomandMattTech. We're on X. God, I still hate saying it. At TMA Cast, at TomParry11 for him, at GameBoyle for me, though I am very rarely on there. I am on Blue Sky now, so if you want that, just ask me for the Blue Sky thing, though I very rarely use it, if I'm totally honest.
Or you'll be part of an exclusive club if you're...
No, I mean, it's open to everyone now. Everyone can have a Blue Sky. Maybe we should set up a Tom and Matt Attack Blue Sky, actually. Maybe that would be a good idea. If you want to listen to this podcast, you can do so in a variety of places as well. It's on blastprocess.com. It is on tomandmattattack.com/podcast. It's also in iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify. Cheeky ratings, subscribe, etc., etc. Tom, thank you as always for podding for me.
Always lovely to have a chat, Matt.
It is, even about disappointing films. And thank you, dear listening audience, for listening to us. We'll be back again next time. I will afraid to say when that'll be because our schedule is a bit manic. But when we speak to you next, be sure that we will talk about Brian Cox. And until then, be sure that it's always the game.
Game on.